Hello and welcome to The Insiders, offering insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm your host, Maria Armudian. In this hour, what can we learn from the making of FDR's New Deal? We'll compare the politics of past and present. Then, what is behind the rise in protection of the super rich in the creation of a winner-take-all politics? The U.S. financial crisis has led many progressives to invoke the New Deal as a potential model with which to fundamentally reform the flaws in the U.S. system. And while the modern circumstances have similarities to the crisis that brought the New Deal, they're also quite different. Still, what can we learn from the program that fundamentally reshaped the country? Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Michael Hiltzig joins us now. His new book, The New Deal, A Modern History, explores the politics and personalities that made the New Deal. Welcome back, Michael Hiltzig. It's great to have you back with us here.
It's nice to be back.
There are some significant similarities, but there are also significant differences when you compare the two time periods. What would you say the most important similarities and differences are?
Certainly, the causes of the Depression, of the Great Depression, and the causes of the Great Recession that we're still living through were very similar. They were both preceded by this period of just frenzied, imprudent investment in assets, periods in which the banks and the financial industry were just over the line, beyond the pale in terms of the risk they were taking and that they imposed on the economy. Housing crisis, there was one in the 20s, and a foreclosure crisis just as there is today. The economic conditions are a lot more similar than I think even today we realize. Now, in terms of differences, I think the political context is quite different in ways that maybe today's citizens don't really understand. Today, you have two parties, arguably both are very homogeneous in terms of their ideology. Certainly, the Republican Party all marches in lockstep with really an extremist wing. In the 1930s, you didn't have this sort of intransigence politically. Both parties, the Republicans and Democrats, had very strong conservative wings and very strong progressive wings. In fact, the leading progressive in the U.S. Senate was Hiram Johnson, senator from California. He had run for vice president for the Progressive Party, the Bull Moose Party, with Teddy Roosevelt in 1912. Well, he was a Republican. And on the Democratic side, the harshest opposition that Franklin Roosevelt faced in getting the New Deal across came from members of his own party, the Southern Democrats, Democratic senators from the Solid South. These are the same people who ended up as Dixiecrats in 1948 and ran Strom Thurmond for president. So Roosevelt really had to juggle both parties. He had supporters and opponents in both. But he didn't have this dyed-in-the-wool intransigence to face that President Obama does.
Political scientists are saying that the polarization is really the greatest in 150 years. Although I saw similarities in the rhetoric from your book, it seems like it's much darker today, or uglier maybe is the word.
Well, it's certainly gotten more extreme, although it was very extreme during the 1930s. And as you said, some of the rhetoric is identical. Roosevelt was accused of being a socialist and a radical. Some of the New Dealers who were his closest advisors, were accused of being communists and socialists and radicals. Roosevelt's ethnic background was challenged. All these sorts of things also happened. But I don't think you did have this extreme polarization in the 1930s, in part because the economic conditions had been so severe and so dark and had gone on for so long that there was much more willingness to just get behind Roosevelt. And even though he didn't have all the answers, and he said he didn't have all the answers, he really showed a willingness to try anything. And for years into the New Deal, the entire country was behind him. He had opposition from big business, opposition from conservatives, of course. But that was really a minority opposition right up until about 1935, 1936.
And in terms of the financial conditions, it seems a little different today in the multinational corporation. With globalization and even more concentration, the power structures may be different. Would you say that's true?
Well, I'd say that in the 1930s, as now, you did have this extreme, you had income inequality, you had inequality of wealth, and you had a concentration of power back then. I think you have that even more so today, as you pointed out. But the bigness in business, this concentration of wealth, was a real concern, not only for many of the New Dealers, but for many of the thinkers who gave life to the New Dealers. Louis Brandeis, who by the time Roosevelt became president was a justice of the Supreme Court, had been a lawyer in Boston, and he had written a book about the concentration of size and wealth in business. And that book had been published in the teens. Adolf Burley, who was one of the original members of Roosevelt's Brain Trust, was an advisor to Roosevelt even before he became president, also was very, very skeptical about concentration of wealth in business. And it was Burley's notion that you had these 600 entities that were controlling an enormous amount of wealth, and he really wanted to help break that up.
Speaking of Burley, his take on individualism was really important. Can you talk about how his take was distinct from what had been in the American rhetoric before?
That's right. Burley, you know, he was a wunderkind. He had been a young graduate of Harvard, I think. He had really made his name as a very young man. And just before Roosevelt's inauguration, Burley had written a memo to FDR, which amounted to a critique of the rugged individualism ethos of Herbert Hoover and going back to Calvin Coolidge. What Burley said is that there really is no individualism because all of these individuals who were lionized theoretically by Republicans, the average man struggling to make his way on his own, well, they were not individuals. They were really at the beck and call of big business and the powers that be. And that Hoover's idea of individualism was not individualism at all. It was really just an excuse for manipulating the great mass of people.
He was part of the Brain Trust, right?
He was one of the original members of the Brain Trust.
Was he one of the people that lasted? There was some rancor in that Brain Trust.
Well, you know, there was this trend in which you see it over and over again that people who started working for FDR early on, even before the 1932 convention that nominated him for president, you can detect, if you read their memoirs and their works, this great devotion and even love for FDR. And often, in almost every case, it begins to fade. And that's a testament to the fact that Roosevelt was a very enigmatic leader. He liked to be all things to all people. And you can see this evolution in which people who went to work for him started working for an FDR of their imagination. And he fed into that. But as reality set in and they worked longer and longer, they began to discover that when Roosevelt faced some political emergency or political exigency, he could shift very quickly and very subtly. And all of a sudden, they were working for a different Franklin Roosevelt. And although they still loved him as a man, they got to be very skeptical of what he was doing and suspicious as to whether he was really following the course that he told them he was. So there was this evolution. So you had a number of members of the Brain Trust who went on into the administration, played very important roles, at least for the first few years. And then you had a few who worked through the campaign, got Roosevelt elected, and then went on to other things. Burley, in fact, went into business. And others did other things. Ray Moley, who was the original member of the Brain Trust, ended up running a magazine that became Newsweek.
This wanting to be all things to all people does sound a little bit like our current president. There's been a huge letdown in the progressive community about what President Obama has put forth that seemed to parallel some of the left during the New Deal. They really wanted him to revolutionize the system, and he didn't do that. He was completely a compromiser. Do you see that as an important parallel?
Well, it is a very important parallel. In fact, I think it's very instructive for progressives today, and we can argue endlessly about whether Obama is too much of a compromiser or just enough or if he shouldn't compromise at all. I don't think we're really going to have an answer to that until we can look at it in a rearview mirror. But I think the reaction among progressives to Roosevelt's course is something that we ought to keep in mind because we've all lived through this before, or at least the country has lived through it. To progressives, Roosevelt looked like the answer when he was elected in 1932 and took office in 1933. But progressives became very disaffected with him, just as they are with Obama, because at heart, Roosevelt was a pragmatist. He knew what he wanted to achieve, and he was a very supple politician, and he did have to walk a line between conservatives and liberals. So yes, progressives got very disaffected with him. Think about this, that the Securities Act of 1934. This is the act that gave us all sorts of transparency and corporate disclosures, gave us the Securities and Exchange Commission, which really, I think, arguably to this day, is still the premier, the gold standard of financial regulation, which is not to say it's perfect. When the final draft was presented on Capitol Hill by the administration, it was viewed by progressives as a total giveaway to Wall Street. And the New Republic, which at that time was a leading progressive voice, the way the New Republic greeted this bill was Wall Street should treat Roosevelt with gratitude, because essentially they thought he's given Wall Street everything it wanted. Now, that's not the way Wall Street saw it, by the way. Wall Street thought that this was going to be a radical, unprecedented intrusion of government into business. But to progressives, there was too much compromise. So I think it's hard to be president under any circumstances and not be a compromiser. We can argue, you know, on the ground as to whether it's too much or not enough or just enough.
One group that he did sell out was the African American.
That's right. That's a very good point. In fact, I have a whole chapter in my book that's entitled The Most Forgotten Man. It's one of the ironies of the New Deal that it was during this period that this great coalition between black voters, especially urban black voters, and the Democratic Party was really forged. Of course, this is a coalition that has really lasted up to the present day. But the New Deal, if its signal failure, its greatest failure, was in racial equality and civil rights. And this was in part because of Roosevelt's perceived need to compromise. He saw that he had this really firm conservative bloc in Congress from the South. They threatened to filibuster any bill that had any sort of racial anti-discrimination component to it at all, including an anti-lynching bill, which was much needed and sponsored by the NAACP. And Roosevelt actually called in the leadership of the NAACP in 1935 or 1936 and said, look, I know you want this, but I can't make it an administration bill because the Southern senators will block everything else I want to do, and I don't think the country can afford that. Now, beyond that, a lot of the work relief programs that the New Deal instituted, they were placed in the hands of local managers at the state level, Mississippi, Georgia, Alabama, what have you. And those managers were essentially allowed to perpetuate racial discrimination in the distribution of jobs, in the distribution of grants, in setting wages between black and white workers. So if you really look at the record, you find that the New Deal really did fail in many fundamental ways its black constituents. In fact, to the point that when 1936 rolled around and the reelection campaign had started, the crisis, which was the house organ at that point of the NAACP, it had been founded by W.E.B. Du Bois, wrote an editorial about the four candidates running for president in 1936. Roosevelt, Alf Landon was the Republican, Norman Thomas was the socialist, and Earl Browder was the communist. And the editorialists for the NAACP said, you know, if you line up all these four candidates in terms of who would be best for the Negro American, to use their terminology at the time, we think number one would be Browder, followed by Norman Thomas, and then Roosevelt. But we want to be practical because we know that Browder and Thomas don't have a chance. So we think you should all vote for Franklin Roosevelt.
It seemed like the racism was pretty rampant in the administration, too. Some of the dialogue that you found. Talk about what it was like within the administration.
Well, there was a very interesting moment when Harold Ickes, who was Franklin Roosevelt's interior secretary and was in charge of a lot of the work relief programs, and he was a true liberal. He was a Republican. He came from Chicago, where he had been president of the Chicago chapter of the NAACP. When he took office in the cabinet, one of the first things he wanted to do was establish an office for racial anti-discrimination, for civil rights. And he did that. But the man he appointed to head that office was a white lawyer from the South. Now, that lawyer came to Ickes and said, you know, you've been talking about improving job prospects for the Negro American, and you want me to take a job that really should go to a Negro American. So why not appoint a black, a distinguished black to this job? And Ickes said, you know, You can turn down the job, but I'm just going to appoint another white because that's what I need to make this office palatable, politically palatable. So he appointed the white lawyer, but the second in command of that office was Robert Weaver, who was a black lawyer, a distinguished black lawyer from the South, who later on became the first black member of the cabinet. But that wasn't until LBJ appointed him in the 1960s. But it started Weaver on his career of public service, which was very distinguished. But you can see how hard it was for even true liberals to negotiate these hoary old concepts of black and white.
The other thing I thought was really important and special about your book, The New Deal, A Modern History, is that you really get kind of an inside view about how difficult policy change really is. If you were going to pick a vignette, what would you say are the most telling that help people understand the complications?
Well, I think probably the best example of all this is the difficult birth of Social Security. You look at Social Security today, this is the second book I've written that touches so deeply on this program, which, as I'm sure you know, I think is really, if you look at the history, the most successful government program in American history. 54 million Americans today receive benefits from this. But it was not an easy thing to get done. To start off with, Social Security initially... It was perceived that the most important component of it would be not old age pensions, but unemployment insurance. Federalize the unemployment system because the states were really tapped out. So that was really the number one goal of the original Social Security drafters. Now, at the time, there was a strong movement for old age pensions that came from the grassroots. Dr. Francis Everett Thompson, a doctor from Long Beach, who had created this nationwide movement, the first movement of the elderly in American history, who were pushing for old age pensions. And in the 1934 election, the Townsend movement, actually elected a number of congressmen. They were sort of the Tea Party of an opposite political stripe of their day. So old age pensions ended up on the front burner. But even up to a few weeks before the final bill was presented to Congress in January of 1935, Roosevelt himself was expressing real skepticism about whether old age pensions should be part of this bill. And he gave a speech and said, "I'm not sure the time is right." Now, there was a furor among the social insurance lobby, and within a day, Roosevelt reversed himself. But he wasn't really sure about this. Now, so Social Security, the bill gets passed, old age pensions really become the principal point. And the goal of the drafters, which was for universal coverage, all Americans were going to be members of this. Well, that was confounded by Roosevelt's Treasury Secretary, Henry Morgenthau, who at the last minute, really this was after the bill had been submitted and it was now being debated in Congress, went before Congress. He had been a member of the committee that had drafted the bill, and he suddenly reversed himself on the stand before a congressional committee and said, you know, it's going to be too expensive for us. So I think you should cut it back. You should cover a lot fewer Americans, and you should raise the payroll tax so that we don't have a deficit. And in fact, at that point, Congress took out coverage for domestic servants, for domestic staff, for farmers, and for many other categories. The first beneficiaries of Social Security, it was a fraction of the number that the original drafters wanted. And all those people were not actually added back into the system until the Eisenhower administration and afterwards. So you can see there were a lot of doubts. Nobody knew how much this was going to cost. Nobody really had gotten their arms around the idea of how much responsibility should we all have for our elderly and for our unemployed. And that's a debate which unfortunately persists today, although to my mind, the debate was won many years ago, but you still hear these points being raised.
I think another aspect that today is different from that time of policymaking is the role of interest groups now in the level of engagement of certain interest groups. How much do you think the balance of interest groups and citizen groups mattered in passing a New Deal? And how would you say that plays out in today trying to rescue our financial situation?
Well, certainly the wealth and the power of many of these interest groups today is much greater than it was then. The Chamber of Commerce can get an entire party really marching to its drummer. It didn't have quite that success in the 1930s, but there were they did exist, and they did exert a lot of influence, and they were a constant thorn in Roosevelt's side. He was constantly battling with the Chamber of Commerce types, with the American Bankers Association. And by the way, they were fighting him with the same arguments. They were saying, "Oh, well, all of these New Deal regulations, they're creating uncertainty, and that's why business isn't investing." And it wasn't any more true then than it really is now. And of
course, did they call them job killers?
Well, I don't think they use that term. That's a fresh term. but that is really that was the point they were making. They were saying, "This is why business is not hiring. It's because businessmen are so uncertain." And of course, the regulations we're talking about back then were regulations on child labor and stock and bond trading and all the things that we now take for granted. So Roosevelt was constantly fighting them. Now, one of the points that I made in the book, I tried not to make it too explicitly because I think readers will understand it implicitly, is that Roosevelt had a much different approach, was much better, in fact, at defending his policies and expressing pride in what he had achieved than I think the White House or the Democrats in Congress are today. I mean, Roosevelt never backed down. And even when, say, in 1938, when he had to talk to the voters at fireside chat and say, look, we still have too much unemployment. We have more than we wanted. We have more than we thought we would have. Economic growth is still too slow, and we're going to need to do more. He would make sure that his listeners understood everything that he had achieved. He would say, look, your money in the bank is safe today. You don't have the fear about your homes and your farms being foreclosed that you had only a few short years ago. Your stock and bond trading is honest today because of our regulations. And we have done all that. We haven't gone all the way, but this is what we've achieved. We're not going back to the Depression of 1932 or 1929. We've beaten that. He also was a very strong, very explicit defender of the concept of government action. He would say, look, you know, there's talk out there that we should send Congress home. But I don't believe in that. I believe that Congress is not an intrusion into our democratic process, because a democratic legislature can never intrude in a democratic country, and that's what we have. And he understood that even inaction is a form of action.
It is indeed.
And inaction was a form of action that had prevailed during the Hoover administration. And he said, That's negative action, and that's not what we're going to do. We're going to work to fix things. We're not going to overturn the system, but we are going to really address the abuses that we have here.
You know, a couple of other things. One is the crisis, the economic crisis of that day. Thomas Lippman, Walter Lippman, sorry, you mentioned, called it a good crisis because it was actually an opportunity. Do you think today we have a good crisis, or do we have what he called a bad crisis?
Well, I think we had a good crisis. I'm not sure we have taken advantage of it. And that was the point.
Lippman, you might explain the right. Good crisis,
well,
bad crisis.
Right. First. The point Lippman made was that there are good crises and bad crises, and a good crisis is one that you can fix and learn from fixing it. And he was specifically talking about the banking crisis of the time, when the banks had all closed. When Roosevelt took office, essentially America's banks were shut. So he declared a bank holiday. He kept them closed for another week or week and a half, and then reopened them bit by bit and made sure the public understood that when the federal government reopened the bank, it was a sound bank, and they should have confidence and put their money back in and no longer have a run on the bank. But by the same token, although there were members of the New Deal and members of the Brain Trust who really wanted to take this opportunity to completely destroy and remake the American financial system, that wasn't going to be Roosevelt's approach. And he marginalized those people. And as I said, he tried to address the abuses. Now, I think today, or over the last few years, we had an opportunity to do that. We could have gotten much stronger regulation in the financial sector, much stronger regulation in the banks, and we didn't walk that last mile. We didn't make this crisis as good as we could have, to use Lippmann's terms. And I'm not sure that we defeated it. I'm not sure that the forces of good regulation and proper regulation really prevail, at least to the point that we've avoided the chance that we're going to have to go through this again too soon.
Well, perhaps that connects to another point you made, which is that the New Deal was really an evolution, and there was more than one really New Deal. So maybe it's all a work in progress.
Well, it was a work in progress then. I think it's a work in progress to this day. Historians sometimes talk about the New Deal and the Second New Deal, the Second New Deal having started sometime in 1935. My approach is really to look at it as a process that did evolve over time, in part because Roosevelt evolved. In fact, he got a lot more doctrinaire. He acquired a fair amount of hubris that I think helped end the New Deal, unfortunately. It did go through many stages, and it got more refined as we went on. The first 100 days, the 100 days that we always talk about, when a new president takes office. For Franklin Roosevelt, whose 100 days were the first 100 days that we've ever talked about, that was really a period of just putting out fires and addressing real crises and doing it as fast and in a quick and dirty way. You could almost argue that the rest of the New Deal was an extended effort to do everything they had done in the 100 days, but do it right. You know, they had a Securities Act during the 100 days. They had to have a new one in 1934 to fix it. They had new banking laws. They remade the Federal Reserve a couple of times. But even since then, we continued to try to remake the New Deal. I think the principle that's the beating heart of the New Deal, which is that we have a shared responsibility, and the instrument of that shared responsibility is the federal government, I think that persists. And despite all the rhetoric you hear about too much government and government's too big, I think most Americans really do understand that and really do agree with it, that when the chips are down, you really do turn to the federal government to help you, you know, to bring disaster relief, unemployment relief, work relief, all these things that were really created as concepts by the New Deal. But we continue to debate how much of that is right, how to deliver it, how can we do it better, how much should we build. Look, America built more during the New Deal than it ever had before or since. To this day, we drive, we fly out of airports built during the New Deal. We drive on its highways. We use the sewer systems that were built then. We use the bridges, and we teach and learn in school buildings that were built by otherwise unemployed men and women of that era. We're still debating how much of that should we do today. So the principle is sound. The instrumentality is still under debate, and the lessons constantly have to be learned and relearned and relearned. And I hope that's the value of this book, is to remind people that these were lessons that were first learned in the 1930s, and that created a principle of action that really is still maybe even more relevant today than it ever has been before.
Perfect place to end. Michael Hiltzik, the new book, The New Deal, A Modern History. Thank you for always enlightening us on these issues.
Well, thank you.
When we come back, we'll take a look at winner-take-all politics, how Washington made the rich richer and turned its back on the middle class. Stay tuned. You are listening to The Insiders, offering insight into today's most pressing issues, and I'm your host, Maria Armudian. The concentration of wealth at the very top of the income pyramid has been noted for many years. But what is causing its continued growth? Our next guests argue that it's not caused necessarily by economic issues alone, so much as political systems. How did we get here, and what's the way out? We're joined by two professors, Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson. Jacob Hacker is professor of political science at Yale University and author of The Great Risk Shift. Paul Pearson is professor of political science at UC Berkeley and the author of Politics and Time and Dismantling the Welfare State. They've both come together once before and written Off-Center, The Republican Revolution and the Erosion of American Democracy. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Well, so perhaps we should start with the actual numbers. You have noted that it's been very hard to get the numbers historically, but that now there have been a couple of economists that tracked it down. How do they look?
You're absolutely right. It's difficult to look at what's happening at the very top of the income pyramid because most of the evidence we have is based on surveys, and there are not a huge number of rich people in the United States, and they tend not to respond to phone interviews. So what has happened in the last 10 years or so is that people have started to really hone in on a unique source of evidence, which we call DNA evidence, namely income tax statistics, which give us a clearer picture than we've ever had of where the rewards of economic growth are going. And what we find is that they're going not just to the top, say the top 10% of Americans, but really to the tiny slices at the very top, the top 1%, the top 1/10 of 1%, even the top 1/100 of 1%. Let me give you a concrete number here. The Congressional Budget Office, using these same income tax statistics, calculated that in 2005, which is the last year they broke it out this way, that the top 1/100 of 1%, that's the richest 11,000 households, had an after-tax income that averaged $24 million a year. And that was up from $4 million average for this group back in 1979. That's a remarkable change. And just to give you a sense of comparison, the middle fifth, the middle 20% of Americans, saw their incomes over this 1979 to 2005 period go from $41,000 a year to $50,000 a year. So we're really talking about a degree of concentration of income at the top that is remarkable and that is sustained. It's happened over the last 30 or 40 years and that has resulted in relatively little trickle down to those lower than the top on the economic ladder.
Paul, would you like to add anything?
The numbers are really astonishing, but just to emphasize this point and how concentrated it is, I mean, I think that's one of the things that is most puzzling to us. People have talked about inequality for a long time, but the fact that the winner's circle is so small really raises interesting and, we think, troubling questions about how the American economy is working and, leading from that, how American democracy is working or isn't working.
Now, Paul Pearson, you've got a colleague over there at UC Berkeley that we've had on this air a few times and that I had worked with while I worked in the legislature, who's a historian who also tracked real income and how much that has shifted for people beyond just this kind of straight-up income, where he looked at things such as, look, you know, you can't even go to a national park anymore without coughing up more money. You can't go to a zoo. You can't go to a museum. School fees have gone up. Did you guys calculate for any of that?
Well, we didn't look so much at the consumption side, what people are spending things on and how much they cost, but we looked in quite a bit of detail at all the different kinds of income, both what people earn but also what they get from government programs, private health insurance, and so on. All of that is calculated into some of these distributional figures. And because some conservatives have argued that, well, you don't take into account things like health care benefits and, you know, things would look more equal, so you're exaggerating how much inequality has grown. But in fact, when you take all those things into account, you still see the same results.
This is Jacob. I would add that we also look at whether or not the middle class has gotten ahead on other indicators. You know, it's clear that most of the economic gains have gone to the richest of the rich. And that's what the statistics are showing uniquely. For the first time, we have evidence that's definitive on this point. But we also looked at whether social mobility, for example, the degree to which people move up the income ladder has accelerated when in this period of rising inequality, or whether health insurance and pension coverage has expanded, or whether people are less likely to have debt or go bankrupt or see their house foreclosed, or how many hours people are working. And just running down the list on all those indicators, the picture looks even worse when you expand your view beyond income and benefits to take into account social mobility and hours of work and so on. And I think this is really why it's so puzzling that this has happened. We ask two questions in the book. We ask, why did this occur? And we argue that policy and what government did and didn't do played a really important role. And so the second question is really, well, how? How did this happen in a democracy where we would expect the middle class to have tremendous political sway, and where these trends have taken place over a 30 or 40 year period?
And before we get into exactly how that happened and the tracing of it, as you did throughout this book, Winner Take All Politics, I really quickly want to look at what you wrote about Europe, how you compared the U.S. to Europe and what you found the difference was.
The fact is that the United States isn't the only country that's experienced rising globalization and increasing reliance on technology, but it's one of the few nations that has experienced a big increase in winner-take-all inequality of the sort that we described, where the gains are going very much to the very top. And of the countries that have experienced that kind of trend, we're far and away the country in which that's been the most pronounced. And I think that raises serious questions about the view that this is somehow inevitably linked to changes in our economy or society, because many of those changes have occurred in other nations that haven't experienced these kind of runaway gains at the top. But it also, of course, allows us to say that there are other economic models that have produced different outcomes. And so we did look to see if Europe, which has experienced much less of a rise in inequality as the United States has, whether or not they had not experienced, say, American levels of economic growth, whether or not there was a kind of a silver lining to the cloud of American inequality. And we did not find evidence of that. And actually, it's surprising how close American economic expansion and European economic expansion are over the 30 or 40 year period we're looking at.
And you also looked across to see if it was educational differences or if it was a skill-based difference, and you essentially rejected all of that because some people with the same education are doing so much better.
Yeah, and I think you don't have to look across the nations to really see that it can't just be that education and skills that are at the heart of the story here. You know, the most common story is that this is about the college-educated pulling away from those who haven't gone to college, but what we're talking about is the very richest of the rich pulling away from the rest of Americans, and 30% of Americans have college degrees and about 10% have advanced degrees. Many of those who are outside the winner's circle are clearly highly educated. So this is really a story about how a very small slice of people have, to use the analogy from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, have received the golden ticket in their chocolate bars that has catapulted them into a world of great riches. And what we want to argue is not just that this is taking place and that it's quite distinctively American, but that it's closely linked to policy and politics, and I think very importantly and puzzlingly, that it has had very negative consequences for the broad middle class.
So let's look at this systemically for a second. And Paul Pearson, let's bring you back in. You point out aptly in the book that the tension really arises between democracy, which is supposed to be equality for all, and a capitalism, which is kind of property-based, ownership-based. So you write that this conflict is what brings it up, and you trace it a bit. So give us a little bit of the background there.
There's been a long-standing interest ever since a democracy started to emerge in what its relationship would be to an economy that often had very high levels of inequality. And some people worried that voters would essentially confiscate the wealth of those who did have property. And others have worried, as we say, that the problem is going to be the opposite, that it's going to be democracy that is going to be squeezed or smothered by the wealthy because they'll be able to translate their disproportionate economic resources into disproportionate political power. And it's a long-standing, not just a philosophical discussion, but a real discussion. The nation's founders discussed these kinds of issues at length and thought about how it'd be influenced as they were trying to introduce at least partial democracy to the United States. And these same issues you know, show up again and again. They show up during the Progressive Era. They show up during the New Deal, and we're seeing them again today. And what we argue is that at least in the current era, there's much more of a risk of this, the second kind of problem, that is that growing inequality and economic power is going to translate into inequality in the political realm as well. And essentially what we try to do in the book is to show how that has happened over the last 30 or 40 years and to show how that control of government has really mattered for reshaping the economy. Just to come back for a second to what we were talking about before, part of the reason why so many economists have said, oh, well, yes, there's been an increase in inequality, but there's nothing really you can do about it. It's just changes in technology or globalization. Part of the reason they've taken that view is that they've argued, well, government itself doesn't really have that much of an effect on the way that the economy operates. And so we argue in considerable detail in the book that these economists have a very narrow view of how government influences the way that the economy works and the distribution of income and rewards within it. You know, financial regulation is obviously a very prominent example in much of what we've experienced, especially in the last decade. Incredible economic challenges are very closely connected to a political process that fueled financial deregulation. And we similarly show in the book that the decline of unions, which we think has made a huge difference, both for the distribution of economic rewards and for the distribution of political power, that this was not just sort of a benign economic process that government didn't have anything to do with. Government played a really important role in helping to shift power away from unions and towards business.
I'd actually like to, if we have time, get into how the globalization fits into it, because it really does. What happened in the U.S. in these shifts in policies, and you also note the changes in the courts with the trial lawyers and those types of things that also protected the very wealthy. But that now has been going on the international scale. So hopefully we can go back to that in just a minute. But before we do that, let me just remind our listeners first that we're speaking with Paul Pearson and Jacob Hacker, and they have co-authored Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. I'd like to back up and go into the 1970s. He started tracing it from World War II, but really 1970s, it was where the change started to be noticeable with the organization of a lot of the CEOs, the Chamber of Commerce, the Economic Roundtable, the Manufacturers Association, and these groups. So, Jacob, let's go back to you.
The 1970s are the forgotten decade of American politics. We tend to locate the roots of our current politics in the ideological clashes, particularly around cultural issues in the 1960s. But in fact, as we show in the book, it's really the 1970s that we see the big shifts that lead to our present economically and politically polarized era. And the year that we identify as the turning point is one that no one mentions, 1978. It was that year that business, as you said, had mobilized, and they started to flex their new organizational muscle around a series of issues, including labor law reform and a consumer protection agency that was being proposed, environmental regulation, and a whole host of other issues, energy. And the end result was that on all these issues, the business position and the conservative position won out, and there was a dramatic showdown in 1978 over labor law reform that involved one of the first sustained filibusters outside the civil rights area that was waged by none other than Orrin Hatch on the Senate floor. So there was just a remarkable shift in the political climate, and it can't be attributed to elections or to the balance of power overall in Congress and the White House. The Democrats, after all, had Congress at that time. The Democrats had the White House. But it was really linked to the changes in the organization of business. And just to give you a sense of this, because back in the 1960s and 70s, business was really quite disorganized. They were not active on a lot of issues. They didn't have a very extensive lobbying presence. Now, when we have 30 lobbyists per member of Congress in Washington, it's easy to forget in this era, back in the 1960s and 70s, that these issues just were not dominated by powerful economic interest groups that now kind of are the sort of major feature of our political climate. So the 1970s is this turning point that brings to power a new, much more muscular, organized business community, along with a very up-and-coming conservative movement that has hitched its wagon to these new organizational realities.
And they were, as I understand, really a counter-movement to Ralph Nader, the environmental groups, and the labor unions that they believed were essentially hurting their profits. And so there was the Lewis Powell memo. You guys mentioned it. Paul, why don't you talk about who Lewis Powell is and what he said?
Well, Lewis Powell, who became famous when he had joined the Supreme Court appointed by Nixon, prior to that had worked in a high-level position for the Chamber of Commerce. And there he penned a famous memo. We don't really want to treat the Powell memo as itself necessarily the catalyst to what happened. It's more symptomatic of a broader shift that was taking place, but it articulates the change in attitudes and behavior within the business community exceptionally well. So it's worth studying for that reason, not as sort of the original source of this movement. Powell basically said, look, we have got to become more politically organized. We are suffering, by we, he meant the business community, we're suffering major defeats in Washington. As you were saying, Maria, this comes towards the later part of a period where Nader and others were winning big victories in Washington, big expansions of environmental regulation and occupational safety legislation and other areas, a big expansion of Social Security. A lot of these things were happening even when you had Richard Nixon in the White House. So again, it's a reminder that while partisanship matters a lot in politics, the organizational playing field and the balance of organizational power also matters a lot. So even with the Republican in the White House, Powell was writing, we're still being badly outflanked by our opponents. So we need to organize. We need to be much more aggressive. We need to find ways to get different businesses to pool their resources and develop a long-term strategic plan and the capacity to execute that plan in politics. And so then you see a whole series of developments. As Jacob said, there's a huge expansion of lobbying. Groups like the Chamber of Commerce expand their organizational capacity. The Business Roundtable represents CEOs and involves a lot of active political participation by the CEOs of the very, very biggest American companies. Business Roundtable forms during this period and quickly becomes quite influential in Washington. The NAM, the National Association of Manufacturers, moves their office from New York, where it had been headquartered for, I think, a century or more, to Washington, because as the director of it said, you know, this is where the action is. We need to be in Washington. So just across the board, there's a huge increase in the political role of business that begins in the 1970s and has just accelerated since then.
There have been since then also some new groups that you mentioned in your book, such as the Club for Growth. And then come the 1980s and into the 1990s, this connection with the right-wing Christian groups. So, Jacob, why don't you take that and talk about that marriage?
Well, one of the things to understand is that this shift in businesses, organization, and power was not occurring in a vacuum. More generally, the big shift that was occurring simultaneously was a decline in what we call middle-class organization. Labor unions were obviously the biggest player in that middle-class organizational world, but they weren't the only middle-class organizations to lose ground. Voluntary federations and fraternal organizations were also losing out to much more professional, much more Washington-oriented and lobbyist-centered organizations. And in terms of the Democratic Party's coalition, they were losing out to what might be called post-material groups, that is, groups that were organized not around bread-and-butter economic concerns, but about issues that resonated with professional and more affluent members of the Democratic coalition, notably feminism, environmentalism. And this shift in the basis of the Democratic Party was occurring, of course, in a different way on the Republican Party side. The big shift for the Republicans is they did bring evangelical Christian conservatives into the fold. This was a very interesting marriage. It was brokered at the elite level by activists in the Christian conservative movement who were particularly angry, not about Roe v. Wade, because it actually, the alliance forms later, but they were very angry about threats that they perceived to Christian schools, particularly in the early 1980s, and grew out of fights over the tax-free status of these schools. And these activists felt very strongly that Christian conservative voters should be aligned with the Republican Party, and they very skillfully brought that alliance into being. Now, there are a lot of commentators who talk about this as if Christian conservative voters are confused about their interests, that because lower-income evangelical voters are more likely to vote for Republican than lower-income secular or non-evangelical voters, that indicates some kind of mistake on the part of these voters. That's not our point at all. Our point is that this was a really important way in which the business community and more affluent members of the Republican coalition were able to enlarge the coalition behind their positions, and this would only have had that kind of effect were it not for the fact that there were those changes that were taking place on the other side with the decline of unions and other voluntary organizations. So the result is that the organizational landscape transforms over this period, and policy and politics shift in response. And we describe this almost as if it's a change in the ecosystem of Washington, that there's this new set of organizational realities, and that changes the kinds of species that can find a niche in the Washington policy jungle and political jungle. And so both parties get dramatically transformed over the next 30 years in ways that reinforce both policy and politics that is conducive to these very concentrated rewards at the top of the economic ladder, to the winner-take-all economy.
One of the sections of your book is called Making America Safe for CEOs. And you were talking about all of these measures, including placing limits on labor unions and limits on ability to file lawsuits against corporate CEOs and corporations, that protected the very rich. Talk about some of these policies that safeguarded CEOs legally.
The list is long, but I think this is Paul. The core point I think that one would want to make about CEOs, and again, this is just one piece of the connection between Washington and the winner-take-all economy. I think you'd also want to think about what's happened to the financial industry for sure. Taxes, where there have been huge changes that favor the wealthy, what's happened to labor unions. But in this case, the thing that we're most interested in is really the way in which corporate governance has evolved in the U.S. in a way that favors the capacity of CEOs to come pretty close to writing their own paychecks. You know, they have docile boards of directors that get a lot of perks from being on boards and are often appointed just sort of one step removed from the CEOs who they then turn around and set salaries for. And as everyone knows, the salaries of CEOs have skyrocketed over the past generation and typically have skyrocketed in ways that don't seem to bear much connection to the actual performance of the companies that these people are the heads of. I mean, obviously, they do well when the companies prosper, but they often do spectacularly well even when they run the companies into the ground, as we've seen in recent years. And Washington has played a role in that as well, mostly just by blocking any attempt to exercise any oversight, any effort that's gone to try to encourage the capacity of shareholders or other groups to exercise a role in corporate governance has been blocked. You know, one of our favorite lines in the book is we recount a story that the head of the SEC under Clinton tells about when they were considering some, you know, fairly modest regulations that would have given shareholders a little bit more leverage in these situations. And the head of the SEC, Levitt, gets called in by Phil Graham, who at that point is the head of the Senate Banking Committee, basically the person who has a lot of control over the SEC's budget. And Graham says to him, unless the water is crimson with the blood of investors, we don't want you engaging in any regulatory flights of fancy. It wasn't long after this that, in fact, the water is crimson with the blood of investors. But Graham, in our book, emerges as a, you know, one of sort of the prototypical figures in developing this very tight connection between a winner-take-all politics and winner-take-all economics.
I think the main thing I'd like to get to now is if we fast forward to today and this election that is happening and the Tea Party patriots, how do you connect all of this?
What the Tea Party is doing essentially is using this organization and its mobilization to press for a very conservative economic agenda. If you look at the electorate as a whole, it's much less mobilized. And in fact, I think over the last 30 years, it's the demobilization of the great broad majority of Americans that has really help perpetuate winner-take-all politics. Most Americans are cynical about Washington and distrustful in part because they think that Washington has worked really well for those at the top, but not really well for the rest of Americans. There's a poll that was done by the Pew Research Center that found that when Americans were asked who the government helped a great deal, that 53% thought that Wall Street had been helped a great deal, but only 2% thought that the middle class had been helped a great deal. Behind it is a really deep sense of grievance about how poorly American democracy seems to be working to represent the middle class.
Where do we go from here? What are the big fixes that might correct the problems that we're facing?
The central message of our book is that politics is at the heart of the problem, and therefore politics has to be at the heart of the solution. A lot of people have told us that, you know, that our book is bracing, that it's hard to read because it describes a lot of problems our country faces that seem deeply intractable. But our view is that these problems are not inevitable. They're not beyond our control. We're not arguing that globalization or technological change makes it inevitable that those at the middle or in the lower rungs of the economic ladder will fall further and further behind a smaller and smaller set of winners at the very top. In fact, since tax policy and what government has done to help or hurt unions and corporate governance policies and a whole host of other measures, financial deregulation being another big example, have exacerbated the winner-take-all economy, changes in public policy and government are going to have to be at the heart of the solution. So we argue that the first order challenge is to think about how to make a new politics in the United States, not a new economy. And I would say that the number one target for the short term will have to be thinking about how to make our political system more responsive to the middle. And that means both making it so that we can actually pass things that matter to Americans. And right now we have a filibuster that requires 60 votes in the Senate on every major issue. It's never been that way in the past. And it's a huge roadblock to addressing middle class concerns. And it also means, and this is a longer-term proposition, but just as crucial, in fact, more crucial, is that we need to figure out ways how to bring Americans more broadly into the political process on the same or relatively similar footing to those who are highly organized right now, the affluent and the ultra-conservative. We need to create middle-class organizations. Rebuilding the labor movement is obviously part of that, but that's a long-term proposition. I think in the short term, we have to figure out ways in which to make politicians more accountable to middle-class voters by increasing both their information and the leverage that they have in the political process.
And the book, again, is called Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. Jacob Hacker, thank you.
Thank you.
Paul Pearson, thank you.
Thanks, Maria.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to Ankina Aghasyan, Melissa Chiprin. If you missed a part of the show, you can always go back to kpfk.org, go to the audio archives. You can always podcast us and follow us at scholarcircle.org, armudian.com, and on Twitter at @armudian. See you next week.